well?
Yeah.
Good. I have to mute this today because I have a cold and I'm afraid that my voice, if I'm at the usual volume, my voice will give out before the end. I have a lot of teaching to do today, so I'm going to use this. If the volume ever becomes not okay, like too loud or too soft, let me know in the beginning, because I'm not very practiced at using a microphone. I almost got us convened at 10:10, but at least we're convened on time. So let's see if there are announcements first. So who has announcements? If you do, raise your hand and make an announcement if you like. Mary. And last.
I just found out recently that the biggest voters are going to have a presentation on the ballot measures on Sunday at First Methodist Church at 3 o'clock in the afternoon. That's this Sunday. The Good Women Voters and the AAU Delta. It's worth attending. What time?
3.
3 o'clock at the First Methodist Church.
Thank you, Mary. Let's see, who else has announcements? Carl? Loud. I'm making it as loud as you can, okay?
Next Tuesday evening, I have a CLL class starting at Wake Center on the subject of rejuvenation biology. And if you're interested in having any of you come, you're all in the audience. It's Route 16 at Wake, and we meet this four times, 12 tonight from 7 p.m. to 9 p.m. And we'll talk about biology, revealing the inner workings of our body, and cell biology, and what it means for medicine, and potentially greatly extended healthy lifespan for each of us.
So this is Carl Blasius, and that's next Tuesday night. Who's next? Betsy, as loud as you...
A reminder about the Awakened World International Film Festival. It starts October 27th and goes through the 30th and 27th is the evening program. There's two movies a day. One's from 9:30 to 12 and one from 2 to 5. It's not just a movie. The first hour is meditation and centering. Then there's the movie and then either the director, the producer, and one new thought leader will be there for deepening of the discussion of what the movie was about. And if you want to go to the whole thing, there's a thing called Celebration Pass, which is for $400, and that will get you into the programs in the evening and the whole festival. Otherwise, each segment is like $45, and there's individual purchases that can be made now. And you can go on the website and see a trailer of each one of the movies to see which one might be. It's going to be a tough choice. Some gentleman came up to me today and said, I need a gal promoting this, and I said yes. He said, oh my God, I don't know what to do. Because you can only go to one of three movies.
That's true.
And the sections are self, society, and spirit. And you don't have the track. So there's all movies on self, spirit, all movies on spirit, and all movies on society. But you don't have to choose just one track. You can go pick and choose what you want.
And they will have Jeff Bridges.
And they will have Jeff Bridges.
And Ram Dass by live stream.
Oh, really? Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
No, Schwartzberg, the guy that Oprah loves, the flower guy, is going to be there the first night showing the movie. What's his name? I don't remember. He's the photographer that does all those amazing
movies. Oh, Louis Schwartzberg.
Yes.
Schwartzberg.
He's going to be here on the 27th.
Oh.
And showing a new film, a little clip of a film. And the people that produced the secret movie, it's the world premiere of their movie. I hate to say it, but it's at the same time that I'm promoting a movie, which is Project Happiness, which has got a little booklet in it that includes several of the tests that Spencer has used in this class, which is what happiness is.
That's great.
And then a 16-minute clip called Slow-Mo, that's a New York Times op doc that you can actually watch. And it's a 60-minute show. So I'm sponsoring those. They'll be at the festival, but if you can't make it there, you can go on and watch the Slow-Mo anytime.
If you want more information, you can get all that. This is Betsy Ingalls. Would you turn off your cell phones, please?
Oh, yeah.
I just heard a little creaking. Okay, other announcements quickly? Julie?
Oh, Edward Maria's poem, because he hasn't read it yet.
I'm going to talk about that in a little while.
Okay.
All right, so any other
announcements?
Okay. Let's see. Let's do some mindfulness first. Oh, no, even before that, want to announce that if you aren't signing in, please sign in and go back to past weeks and sign in so that it's accurate. Second, if you didn't get a pink ballot, not now, but in a little while when I describe what that's for, go get one and only one pink ballot. You only get to vote once. But I do need some information from you today. It isn't a ballot for out there, it's a ballot for in here. Okay. Want to talk about two aspects of mindfulness very briefly. First aspect has to do with the witnessing perspective. I think the most common error that people make when they try to be mindful is they try to be mindful. That is, they sit down and say, okay, I'm going to witness now. And they make the effort to pay attention to whatever is happening. And that's good because they're paying attention to what's happening, but they're doing it while they're thinking. They're thinking of what's happening. That's better than not thinking of what's happening. But it's not what witnessing really is. Is it still okay?
Yeah, all right.
I feel you.
Eating an ice cream cone or something. In order for the witnessing perspective to emerge, one has to simply keep returning attention to the breathing and opening awareness. So you're noting a sound, a thought, a feeling, a sound, your breathing, and you keep coming back to your breathing every time you lose it, so that you're fairly continuously aware of it, or you keep returning to it. And at the same time, you're noting this, that, and the other. You're not labeling it necessarily, you're just noting. And if you keep doing that, if you keep just returning to your breathing and letting your awareness notice whatever it notices, at some point, what will emerge is a sense of an unlimited awareness in which everything occurs. There'll be a distinction between this field of awareness, this capacity to notice, which seems to have no dimensions, it seems to be infinite. And there will be your breathing, and a thought, and another thought, and a sound, and a thought about the sound, and a feeling, and these things will all pop up, they'll emerge. In this field of awareness. Now, the field of awareness is different than thinking that you have a field of awareness. So how do you get from that habitual thinking that you're immediately and always doing? You just keep coming back to your breathing no matter what else. You let everything be just as it is. You don't try to change anything or understand anything. You just come back to your breathing and there will be an automatic noticing. You know, you're breathing, and then there'll be a sound, your attention will go there, you'll notice your attention goes there, you'll come back to your breathing. So what I just told you is the bottom line for this whole thing is just soften and open and come back to your breathing. You soften and open and come back to your breathing, and the witnessing perspective will emerge by itself. How long does it take? With practice, it comes very, you know, a few seconds. But when you're first learning it, it doesn't come at all. There's not a clear distinction between awareness and thought. That distinction, those things are so fused that it takes practice for those things to separate from one another. That's the first aspect. The second aspect I want to talk about is a little bit of what I talked about last time, which is translucency. I need a diagram for this. There are three realms of your existence, three domains of your existence. One domain is the domain in which we habitually reside, and that's the domain of personality and body. If you ask a person on the street, who am I? They'll say, my thoughts, my feelings, and my body. We're so identified with this domain that we really, we're fairly unaware of the other two domains. The other two domains are the world and other people, and the witness is the awareness in which these things occur that I just talked about. So what does this translucency I'm talking about mean? It means not that you don't have these things always. It means that these things are not your only focus, and it means that you can look from your awareness out through these things at the world and other people. So you make more authentic contact with the world and other people because this isn't what stops your awareness. This isn't opaque. It becomes translucent. So when you talk to somebody else and you are mindful, you feel your breathing, you feel your awareness, you hear your thoughts, you see your thoughts, you feel your feelings, you feel your body sensations, and most of your attention can flow very easily through you so that when the other person talks to you, it comes directly into the core of you. The connection is pretty complete between you and this. But when you see something, you don't immediately start thinking about it and abstract it. You actually really, truly, 100% see it. When you're mindful and you are interacting, you would think that when you're mindful, you're into yourself and you're really unaware of the world, but that's not what mindfulness is. What mindfulness is you are open to all the possibilities for experience. So the world and other people have access to your full attention because your full attention isn't stuck here. That makes sense to people. So how do you do this? Well, what you do is frequently throughout your day, your life, you practice breathing, softening, and opening so that the layer of your personality and body are within your awareness, but they're not absorbed in them. So you have the feeling of the deeper you, the more authentic you, the more essential you, and you have much more of an intimate connection with the world. Right, so that's enough theory. Because this is all we've just spent the last 10 minutes in here. I said, lucky thoughts, you know, but so let's sit again. I'm going to try to turn off the lights so people don't think that they're conducive to sitting.
I could ask you, what are you going to do now? But your answer would be nothing. I'll say one more thing about that. I always say this is not about fixing yourself. You can add that on if you like. But at this point, just open to whatever is and just let the weather be whatever the weather is. Your job is just breathe open so that you're aware of the weather without interacting with it or becoming it.
Few announcements that I'm going to make. First, upcoming classes. Today and next week, I'm going to be talking about a variety of subjects, all of which hopefully will tie together at some point. So today and next week, I'm going to be teaching. And then in 2 weeks, I have the two psychotherapists coming, and the three of us will sit in the front of the room and just be open to questions about the process of psychotherapy and personal growth. I think that'll be very interesting. These are two extremely experienced and good therapists. And then in 3 weeks, which is Halloween, we'll do some sort of experience in class that has to do with the psychological meaning of Halloween. Let's see. In terms of the art, I've always wanted to make a community out of this to the extent possible, and we've kind of lost some of that because there's so many of us, and because we're in this room rather than 31, and because we only have an hour and a half versus 2 hours, and because they have to kind of break down the room right after we leave here. So one of the community aspects that seems to be threatened is the art, which I really love. So what I was able to do was kind of broker a deal, I think. It's still not inked, but I think the possibility is that on October 31st, we'll be able to sit here for another 15 minutes. And in that, I mean, you don't have to, I'll dismiss class 11:45, but in that last 15 minutes, if people have art and they bring it in, we can, they can talk about their art a little bit. So if there are 5 or 7 or 10 different artists, we can give a minute or two to each of them, and they can say, this is what this is, this is what this is, this is what this is. So at least we can have a 15 or 20 minute art show on the 31st. So if you do have any art you would like to bring in and share, you can do it any week, just put it over there or put it anywhere. But in terms of getting a chance to present it to the group, I think that on the 31st is when that will actually happen.
About the poem from April.
So the poem would happen on the 31st.
Okay.
It couldn't happen today because, unfortunately, we have constraints on how long we can be in here.
Yeah.
Okay, the next thing is, what are those ballots all about? For the winter, this class is scheduled for the same, in the same framework it currently exists. That is 8 weeks, an hour and a half from 10:15 to 11:45, and $60. So the question is, someone came up after last class and said, several of us have been talking, and we like the old format of 2 hours better, and we would be willing to pay $80. I thought about it, and I thought, I don't like the old format better because of two reasons. One, because it's $80, not $60. And secondly, because in that 2 hour class, we had a break in the middle and it kind of made the class discontinuous. So I didn't like that idea. So I thought, well, what's the compromise idea here? Which is, I wonder if they would let us meet from 10:15 to noon, 15 minutes longer. We would have one continuous class, but it would give us an extra 15 minutes. So think that it feels all compressed. And that would be $70 rather than $60 for the 8 weeks. So I called my programmer and said, could this happen? And she said, I don't see any reason why not. So what I need to know is, we need to have a vote. And
how would this, the scholarships go out?
I don't know anything about the scholarships, Julie, no more than I do.
Oh, that's separate.
Okay, so this is not for winter, this is for spring. We're talking about for winter, it's already 8 weeks, $60, same time frame. For spring.
What's the title of the class for winter? What's the title?
Same thing, consciousness class. Okay, for spring, I need you to write down on this pink ballot one of three statements. If you write any other stuff, I'll read it, but it won't count. Okay. Here's what you vote for. Okay. Here, vote for one and only one of these three. This covers the possibilities. Well done. Okay. You get to either put prefer 1 3/4 hours at $70, so just write that. If you prefer that, that would be better. If you're okay with that, but you'd like to keep it the way it is, put okay with 70, prefer 60. And if you're not okay with 70, if that would be too much, and you need to keep it at 60, you would like to strongly put not okay with 70.
I kind of figured, thank you.
No.
The
MIT was good for something. So write one of those down, and then where's Chris, my person who does everything?
I already
have those. Would you collect them, Chris?
Sure.
Okay, so you can fold them over and give them to Chris. He's going to be the collecting. What? Yes, and Fred. Chris and Fred are going to collect them.
Pass them towards the center.
I'm going to read to you a short article from the New York Times from a couple months ago, and several people sent this to me, but I think the first person to do so was Tim Gill, so thank you, Tim, wherever you are, for this. All right, so this article that I want to read and comment on a little bit is called No Time to Think. One of the biggest complaints in modern society is being overscheduled, overcommitted, and overextended. Ask people at a social gathering how they are, and the stock answer is super busy, crazy busy, or insanely busy. Nobody is just fine anymore. When people aren't super busy at work, they're crazy busy exercising, entertaining, or taking their kids to Chinese lessons. Or maybe they're insanely busy playing fantasy football, tracing their genealogy, or churning their own butter. And if there's ever a still moment for reflective thought, say while waiting in line at a grocery store or sitting in traffic, out comes the mobile device. So it's worth noting a study published last month in the journal Science, which shows how far people will go to avoid introspection. Quote, "We had noted how wedded to our devices we all seem to be, and that people seem to find any excuse they can to keep busy," end quote, said Timothy Wilson, a psychology professor at the University of Virginia and lead author of the study. Quote, "No one had done a simple study letting people go off on their own and think," end quote. The results surprised him and have created a stir in the psychology and neuroscience communities. In 11 experiments involving more than 700 people, the majority of participants reported that they found it unpleasant to be alone in a room with their thoughts for just 6 to 15 minutes. Moreover, in one experiment, 64% of men and 15% of women began self-administering electric shocks when left alone to think. These same people, by the way, had previously said they would pay money to avoid receiving the painful jolt. It didn't matter if the subjects engaged in contemplative exercise at home or in a laboratory, or if they were given suggestions of what to think about on the coming vacation. They just didn't like being in their own heads. It could be because human beings, when left alone, tend to dwell on what's wrong in their lives. This is called, by the way, the negativity bias. We have evolved to become problem solvers and meaning makers. What preys on our minds when we aren't updating our Facebook page or spinning in class are the things we haven't figured out. Difficult relationships, personal professional failures, money trouble, health concerns, and so on. And until there is resolution, or at least some kind of understanding or acceptance,
These thoughts reverberate in our heads. Hello, rumination. Hello, insomnia. Eyelid. Hello, depression.
What was that from?
This, I was still reading. It's from the New York Times. Okay. There is a school of thought that says the reason that we have conscious awareness is because it helps us solve problems. It helps us with our difficulties. The creature that evolved to be able to bring difficulties front and center in consciousness had an advantage over the creature that didn't think about his or her difficulties. And so the whole deal with your consciousness is it is a looker for difficulty and worker on solving that difficulty. I don't think that's true, but that's probably the predominant theory of why we're conscious these days in psychology. One explanation why people keep themselves so busy and would rather shock themselves is a quote, one explanation why people keep themselves so busy and would rather shock themselves is that they're trying to avoid that kind of negative stuff, end quote, said Ethan Cross, director of the Emotion and Self-Control Laboratory at the University of Michigan. Quote, it doesn't feel good if you're not intrinsically good at reflecting, end quote. That is one reason why when I teach mindfulness in various groups, a lot of people don't continue even though they see the value, because what happens is they become more aware of what's on their mind and it's aversive to them, and so they don't move through that level of difficulty with what they initially find. And they go away because they'd rather not know. The comedian Louis C.K. has a riff that's been watched nearly 8 million times on YouTube in which he describes that not good feeling. Quote, sometimes when things clear away and you're not watching anything and you're in your car and you start going, oh no, here it comes, that I'm alone, and it starts to visit on you, just this sadness, he said. And that's why he texts the drive. People are willing to risk taking a life and ruining their own because they don't want to be alone for a second because it's so hard. Unquote. But you can't solve or let go of problems if you don't allow yourself time to think about them. It's an imperative ignored by our culture, which values doing more than thinking, and believes answers are in the palm of your hand rather than in your own head. Quote, it's like we're all in this addicted family where all this busyness seems normal when it's really harmful, end quote, said Stephanie Brown, a psychologist in Silicon Valley and the author of Seed, Facing Our Addiction Fast and Faster and Overcoming Our Fear of Slowing Down. That's the name of her book. Quote, there's this widespread belief that thinking and feeling will only slow you down and get in your way. But it's the opposite, end quote. Suppressing negative feelings only gives them more power, she said, leading to intrusive thoughts, which make people get even busier to keep them at bay. The constant strain, cognitive strain, of evading emotions underlies a range of psychological troubles, such as obsessive-compulsive disorder, anxiety, depression, panic attacks, not to mention a range of addictions. It's also associated with various somatic problems like eczema, irritable bowel syndrome, asthma, inflammation, impaired immunity, and headaches. So what's being said here is if you don't feel your feelings, it will come out as troubled behaviors or troubled physical symptoms. I need to mention something. Last night, I teach positive psychology at City College, and last night we were reading a chapter of Authentic Happiness by Martin Seligman, in which he said, it was wrong to teach people to pound pillows to get in touch with their feelings. Research shows that when people dwell on their anger, they get worse. They get angrier. They get high blood pressure. More angry people get heart attacks, et cetera, et cetera. So he said, it's better just to let the feelings dissipate by emotional osmosis. The implication was don't feel your feelings. He went too far to that side in making that argument. So what I talked about last night is it is unhealthy to either dwell on your feelings and magnify them, feed them, go over the old hurt over and over and over in your mind so you get angrier and angrier and angrier. You know? So overemphasizing feelings, overfeeling them, holding on to them, re-traumatizing yourself is clearly not okay. But on the other hand, ignoring your feelings, suppressing them, saying, I'm not upset, I'm not angry, doing distracting yourself so you don't feel them seems to be equally unhealthy. That is, if you ignore your feelings, it comes out as behaviors and physical symptoms. So what do you do about your feelings? The middle ground is, what was right? The middle ground is what you do. You feel your feelings completely. You let them move through you, but you don't hold on to them. You don't try to push them away. That's Buddhism again, right? You don't grasp and you don't push away. You just let them move through you. You let them, you experience them completely. You let them come. You let them be. You let them go. So the idea is you have a full emotional life, but it's not an emotional life that captures you, and it's not an emotional life that captures you by trying to avoid it. Because you can spend all your time pushing aspects of yourself out of consciousness. That's what Freud's theory was all about, is people making an unconscious for themselves because of the things that they won't allow themselves to be conscious of. So what that paragraph that I just read to you said is, it's really important to be aware of what you're feeling and let yourself feel your feelings as they occur. But if you're mindful, you let the storm blow through without trying to change the storm, but you don't identify with the storm. It's just stuff, energy moving through you, emotion, energy, emotion. Studies further suggest that not giving yourself time to reflect impairs your ability to empathize with others. Quote, the more in touch with my own feelings and experiences, the richer and more accurate are my guesses of what passes through another person's mind, end quote, says Giancarlo DiMaggio, a psychiatrist with the Center for Metacognitive Interpersonal Therapy in Rome, who studies the interplay of self-reflection and empathy. Quote, feeling what you feel is an ability that atrophies if you don't use it. So what he's saying is, if you're more in touch with your own feelings, you're more in touch with other people's feelings because you're more aware of feeling. This would probably happen through mirror neurons. The neurons in your brain which feel what somebody, which mediate empathy. They feel what the other person feels. If you're not in touch with your own feelings, apparently those neurons don't work so well with regard to other people's feelings. Researchers have also found that an idle mind is a crucible of creativity. A number of studies have shown that people tend to come up with more novel uses for objects if they're first given an easy task that allows their minds to wander rather than a more demanding one. In other words, when you're just reflecting, when you're sitting by a pond and just kind of looking at the water, just kind of letting your thoughts meander, then your thoughts meander in creative directions. But if you're constantly filling your mind with stuff you have to do or are doing, then that creative level never emerges. You remember I told you about the four steps of creativity. The classic research, almost 100 years old in psychology. Four steps to create the creative process. Step one, which is the step that most people never leave, is the step of preparation. It's when Albert Einstein is sitting there in the patent office in Bern, Switzerland, in 1905, this is before 1906, when he comes up with a special theory of relativity, and he's trying to figure out why it is that all the measurements are saying that light doesn't vary its speed. Every time you measure light, it's the same value. And that doesn't fit with physics. I mean, why should something not vary its speed when it goes through different mediums? It should be slowed down by the medium. Nobody can figure this out. It's the great puzzle. And so he tries to figure it out, and he gives up. I can't do it. You know, he turns it over his mind over and over and over and over and over, and it doesn't work. Light should be varying in speed based on what medium it passes through, but it doesn't. The experiment shows it doesn't vary. So what he does is he gives up. And when he gives up, that's stage two of the creative process. That's called incubation. In incubation, it's not that you're not thinking about it. It's just that you're not thinking about it consciously. It's going, if you will, from the dominant hemisphere of your brain to maybe the non-dominant hemisphere, who knows where else. At a certain point, Archimedes is in the bath, and he's looking at the soap floating, and he goes, "Eureka!" And he runs naked through the streets of Athens, because he has realized a problem, the solution to a problem, the solution of specific gravity. Einstein goes, "Oh my God, I understand." I mean, he has a vision, you know, it's a visual process, which is non-dominant hemisphere. He realizes that he's been looking at light from the point of view of the world and saying, the world is, we all know that the world isn't varying. Time and space don't vary. So light has to vary its speed, and it doesn't. If we look at the world from the point of view of light, if we hold light speed constant, like the experiments show, then the world will vary. Time and space, which seem like they don't vary, will change. And as you know, time and space do change. Even though intuitively, locally, we don't see time and space as change, when we go very fast or very slow, things slow down, speed up, lengthen, and shorten. So that, yeah.
Einstein often said when you couldn't think anymore, you'd grab the violin, play for a few minutes, and then you came.
Yeah. So the point about this is if you are constantly trying to solve a problem. Any difficult problem is a creative act. You go back and forth, should I do this, a billion times, and you never stop that. Day and night, you're going back and forth, should I do this. You'll never come, that's A or B. You'll never come to C, a superordinate position, which gives you the best of both A and B, if you stay on the level of A and B. Einstein again said, the significant problems we face cannot be solved by the same level of thinking that created them. So what this argues is if you don't clog your mind up all the time, but you let your mind just be open, you reflect, you let go of trying to figure it out, then preparation gives way to incubation. At a certain point, illumination comes from deeper in your mind, and then the fourth stage is verification, when you then use your intellect again and say, okay, how could this work? What?
What was third?
The third is illumination. Oh my God. It pops into your open, relaxed mind in a dream, in the bath, you know, when you're walking in nature. When you're not on your cell phone, you know, when you've got just an open, reflective mind, then solutions, problems, creative impulses can come into your mind because your mind isn't all clogged up with normal verbal thinking. And then step four is verification, where you again, think intellectually and say, okay, well, how would this work? Let me think this through. And then I say I have to do the math and find out if everything works, and it does. Oh, so back to the article. I quote, idle mental processing encourages creativity and solutions because imagining your problem when you aren't in it is not the same as reality. says Jonathan Smallwood, a cognitive neuroscientist at the University of York in England. Using your imagination means you're in fact rethinking the problem in a new way. Perhaps that's why Google offers its employees courses called Search Inside Yourself and Neural Self-Hacking, which include instruction on mindfulness meditation, where the goal is to recognize and accept inner thoughts and feelings rather than ignore or repress them. Actually, it's not for creativity that they offer that. They offer that because people who are troubled don't work as well. And when you do mindfulness, you can, you know, deal with your anxiety and depression better, and then you'll be more productive. It's in the company's interest because it frees up employees otherwise in baffled brain space to intuit the end user's desires and create products to satisfy them. Again, I don't think that's why they teach those things. I think those things because it keeps people are totally stressed out a little saner so they can work better. Quote, I have a lot of people who come in and want to learn meditation to shut out thoughts that come up in these quiet moments, says Sarah Griesemeyer, a psychologist in Austin, Texas, who incorporates mindfulness meditation into her practice. But, quote, but allowing and tolerating the drifting in of thoughts is part of the process, end quote. Her patients, mostly hard-charging professionals, report being more productive at work and more energetic and engaged parents. So what she said, what the paragraph initially said is, people come to meditation to get away from their thoughts, to get away from their troubles. But in fact, when you meditate, you become more aware of your troubles, just less identified with them. To get rid of the emotional static, experts advise not using first-person pronouns when thinking about troubling events in your life. Instead, use third-person pronouns or your own name when thinking about yourself. If a friend comes to you with a problem, it's easy to coach them through it. But if the problem is happening to us, we have real difficulty, in part because we have all these egocentric biases making it hard to think rationally, said Dr. Cross of Michigan. Quote again. The data clearly shows that you can use language to almost trick yourself into thinking your problems are happening to someone else, end quote. So when it's me I'm thinking about, I'm not very rational. But when I'm thinking about somebody else, then it's really clear. You know, we all have that experience. So if you can objectify your own thoughts, and that's what you do when you're mindful. As Carl Jung said, when you walk into a room, you don't think you put the people in the room, right? Well, it's the same thing with your thoughts. Your thoughts are not you. Most of them have been put in there by other people. You just notice them as residing in your consciousness, but they're not personal. They're objective. They're just messages, some of which are accurate, some of which are not accurate. Hard as they sometimes are, negative feelings are part of everyone's life, arguably more so if you're crazy busy. But it's those same deep and troubling feelings and how you deal with them that make you the person you are. While busyness may staunch welling sadness, it may also limit your ability to be overcome with joy. So I just thought that was an interesting article because increasingly what we're seeing is people who have no inner life. The minute that there is a moment, the moment that there is not something coming at their consciousness from outside, they pull out their phone and they connect. Robert?
Yeah. One thing that people have noticed is that this is really being done to children in a way that didn't occur when we were all growing up.
We talked about this a little before, so I won't go into it totally, but two nights ago, I talked to one introductory psychology class about this, and I said to them, You guys have 1 foot in your camp. You have 1 foot in the camp of Homo sapiens sapiens, like me, and you have the other foot in the camp of Homo sapiens technobilis. I just made that up, but the new kind of person who doesn't have a self at all, but only has a self in terms of connection. You know? And your younger brothers and sisters, they're gone. They got sucked into their phone and they're never coming out. And the phone is just the tip of the iceberg. Wait till the watch happens. Wait till the implant happens. Wait till Google Glass goes commercial rather than beta. You know? The kids that are growing up now will never have a moment of self-reflection. And so if they never have a moment of self-reflection, they never have a moment of self. Is that a bad thing or a good thing? Maybe what's happening is our individual minds are merging into a common mind. And the kids that are growing up now will be not individuals at all, but will be part of a social fabric. I don't know if it's good or bad, but it's certainly different.
Maybe two common minds contaminating all these individual minds.
Well, that's the sinister way to look at it. I mean, when I get science fiction-y, I think that... when I get science fiction-y, I think that we have been invaded by aliens, and we created them. Silicon-based life, and it eats information and has enslaved the entire human race to feed it. And even though that's a crazy paranoid notion... I'm about to take you to information land. So let me take you to information land, okay?
I'm just simply mind control, quote unquote. Just mind control, quote unquote.
Well, I don't see it as a conspiracy of some people to control our minds. I see it as a conspiracy of the devices to control all people. I'm even crazier than the conspiracy theorists. Okay, anyway, there.
Okay. I agree with the article, but in the beginning, I thought you were going to talk about the fact that most people are afraid of being lonely. And so therefore they allow these things.
The motive, I think the driving force that, behind a lot of the connection is that people, when they're alone, it's an uncomfortable feeling for them. They immediately get lonely because they haven't learned how to be with themselves. So there's a loss or a vacuum, and it drives them to a panic, and they pull out their phone instantly because it's the only state that they know is lonely. They don't know the state of alone. It's not something they've learned. And we learned it when we were little because there were a lot of times when we were lying in the crib watching the rattle, or when our parents weren't there, or when we were walking when we were little, that we weren't constantly besieged by the information. So we have a relationship with ourselves, and we know the difference between lonely and alone. But a kid that has never had the experience of being alone without stuff coming at her or him, that kid has no experience of being alone without being lonely. I mean, it's a bizarre experience to not have information. The kid has information all the time. There's no time when there isn't information from outside surrounding that child. Let's see. I know where we're going here, so we'll go here. Robert, then Petale, then Michael, and then we got to move on. Okay.
Yeah, I actually meant something slightly different, which was the fact that children have their lives overscheduled. So we were used to the idea of going out to play in our own creative way.
Right.
I mean, we could play for an hour with a stick or something, and kids are taken passively from one organized activity to another.
Right, so there's no creativity because everything is structured. Also, kids don't read. Reading involves you have to make a world in your head. Visual, the world is already fed to you in your head. There's research that shows that people that are fed more visual information are actually less imaginative because they haven't developed that faculty. Okay, Petale, and then Michael, then we'll continue.
Okay, growing up in Vermont, as soon as school was over, I'd run across this swinging bridge over a river and up this cliff. I couldn't even look down now because I have vertigo, into this forest thicket that nobody knew about, with the lichen and the mushrooms and the trees, and I would meditate till it was time to supper, and I'd run down to go home. My mother never knew where I was. Nobody asked. And now you have to know where your child is every second.
Yeah. Every second. And your child, the minute that, if you don't believe this, go to City College and watch what happens as kids come out of class. Every single person pulls out their phone, and you know, the data are, I don't believe the data are, people have, kids have a screen in front of them 7.5 hours a day, you know, and 11 hours a day if you count multitasking, and texting and talking on their cell phones. So there's no world apart from structure.
The other half of what I was going to say, I really have my miniaturization. I tossed my cell phone about 6 years ago. I would only use it to call a taxi anyway. And I want a big world. And to have it all in this little tiny thing, and I'm at home with myself, I crave being alone.
Okay,
so, my power.
So that big versus little thing, if you're mindful, the world gets bigger and bigger and bigger because you're not focused on your own, even your own thought process. You're out of your own head. So the world takes on dimension. Contrast that with what happens when you pull out your phone. The world narrows down to that screen. So it's the opposite of the big world. The world goes away. It shrinks into nothing. So, Michael, and then I do want to continue. Okay.
Could this be another artifact or result of the Industrial Revolution? It used to be said that an idle mind is the devil's workshop.
Devil's playground.
Devil's playground. Perhaps this is an attempt to escape the perception of being negatively idle.
Yeah, but again,
doing something.
For most people, it started out this. Article started out by saying that for most people, the minute that they're idle, come up all their worries, and that's negative. But that's not all that's in your mind. If you're willing to tolerate the initial problem-solving static and kind of let that float through, then there are all the deeper levels of yourself that people have no idea of. Anyway, this is... We've talked about this before. Let's go further. Okay. Now, I entered this doorway with risk because I don't really know that much about it. It mystifies me, but I know that we have to talk about this. It's a scary two words for me. But these two words are big data. How many people have heard of big data? Raise your hand. Well, those of you who have, you can chime in here because you're going to have to help me. But those of you who haven't, where have you been? Let me tell you a little about how the world has changed very, very recently. From Fortune magazine. I got this for $2 last year. Okay, I never read Fortune before, but it's totally fascinating. It's a whole other world for me. So this is from Fortune magazine.
What issue?
This issue is June 16th of this year. There we go. With more internet-connected devices, machines, and applications talking to one another than ever before, corporations are amassing unprecedented mountains of information. Case in point, a full 90% of all the data in the world has been created over the past 2 years. 90% of the data in the world has been gathered in the past 2 years.
So the first question that comes up is, where is all this stuff? I mean, that's a lot of information that's being gathered. Where do they keep this? Well, they keep it in the cloud, right? Where exactly is the cloud? Well, let me tell you, okay? The current aggregate U.S., and this is happening all over the world, by the way, this is just U.S. numbers. The current aggregate U.S. floor space of data centers is about 660 million square feet. The largest data center, there are many data centers that are several hundred thousand square feet. The largest data center is Google's in New York City, which is 2,900,000 square feet. Now, how big is that? Costco out here is about 125,000 square feet. I think I read that. So this data center is 24 Costcos put together. Now, is that like toothbrushes? You know, do they store it like toothbrushes? You know those flash drives that store 34 and 32 gigabytes of information that you could never fill up even with your photographs? That's what storage is. Now, I assume in these data centers, some of that storage is old-style disk storage. But even if it's disk storage, can you imagine how much storage there is in 2,900,000 square feet in that one data center? There are these absolutely enormous buildings whose function is to store all the information that is being gathered about you. Let's see. What do I want to do? I just want to mention something called the Internet of Things, which I don't really fully understand, but apparently what is about to happen is many devices that we have in our lives are about to talk to one another. That is, your thermostat, your cell phone is about to tell your thermostat, I'm coming home in half an hour, turn up the heat. You know about smart meters, which constantly tell somebody about how much electricity. Do you ever notice when you go on Amazon, information about what you looked at recently? Well, that data has to be stored somewhere, you know, so that when you go back there, it pulls all that stuff up. I always am amazed that every 2 months I get a mailing from Ralph's, and there's, by some lucky chance, they give me coupons for just the stuff that I want to buy. How do they do that?
Do you know that they deliberately mix in ones that are irrelevant so that you don't get too paranoid?
That you're being tracked.
Yeah. Okay.
So I don't really understand how the current estimation is by the year 2020 there will be between 26 and 30 billion interconnected devices, all of which have to use the internet to connect with one another. That's going to be a challenge to deal with that much information. So 26 to 30 billion devices, that's way more than there are people, so each of us is going to have several at least of those devices. Now, I don't know what all those devices are going to be. I just know that the amount of data that is going to be generated is going to dwarf the amount of data that currently exists.
In about 10 years?
No, it's starting now.
6 years.
All right, so let's look a little bit at this explosion of information and what it means for our lives. By the way, I won't get
through with all of my program for today, but I have 2 weeks, so next week we'll continue with this. And where I'm eventually headed is to this MIT Technology Review article issued from a couple of months ago called Hacking the Soul. So we're going to get there. Okay. 59. Okay. I'm going to read you a little bit from a short article from Technology Review. This is MIT's Magazine of Technology from May, June of this year. This is called Agricultural Drones. Ryan Kunde is a winemaker whose family's picture-perfect vineyard nestles in the Sonoma Valley north of San Francisco. He's also a drone operator, and he's not alone. He's part of the vanguard of farmers who are using what was once military aviation technology to grow better grapes using pictures from the air, part of a broader trend of using sensors and robotics to bring big data to precision agriculture. What drones means to Kunde and the growing number of farmers like him is simply a low-cost aerial platform. A low-cost aerial camera platform. Either miniature fixed-wing airplanes, or more commonly, quadcopters and other multi-bladed small helicopters. These aircraft are equipped with an autopilot using GPS and a standard point-and-shoot camera controlled by the autopilot. Software on the ground can stitch aerial shots into a high-resolution mosaic map, whereas the traditional radio-controlled aircraft need to be flown by a pilot on the ground. In Kunde's drone, the autopilot does all the flying from auto takeoff to landing. Its software plans the flight path, aiming for maximum coverage of the vineyards, and controls the camera to optimize images for later analysis. So this is an automatic thing. The thing takes off, it flies around, given what it has learned, it modifies its flight path, it takes pictures, it stitches them together into a data picture of the vineyard. Okay. Drones can provide farmers with three types of detailed views. First, seeing a crop from the air can reveal patterns that expose everything from irrigation problems to soil variation and even pests and fungal infections that aren't apparent at eye level. He's getting a bird's eye view of his field, he's seeing what's dry, what variation there is in how the crops like the soil at particular places, and where in the crop is their infestation. Second, airborne cameras can take multi-spectral images, capturing data from the infrared as well as the visual spectrum, which can be combined to create a view of the crop that highlights differences between healthy and distressed plants in a way that can't be seen with the naked eye. Finally, a drone can survey a crop every week, every day, or even every hour, combined to create a time series animation. That imagery can show changes in the crop, revealing troubling spots or opportunities for better crop management. What's being said is all this data that's being collected automatically here is making the farmer able to grow a better crop. It's part of the trend toward increasingly data-driven agriculture. Farms today are bursting with engineering marvels, the result of years of automation and other innovations designed to grow more food with less labor. Tractors autonomously plant seeds, that is, tractors by themselves plant seeds within a few centimeters of their target locations, and GPS-guided harvesters reap the crops with equal accuracy. Extensive wireless networks backhaul data on soil hydration and environmental factors to faraway servers for analysis. So that's where some of this information is going. It's going far away to be analyzed. But what if we could add to these capabilities the ability to more comprehensively assess the water content of the soil?
become more rigorous in our ability to stop irrigation and pest problems, and get a general sense of the state of the farm every day or even every hour. The implications cannot be stressed enough. We expect 9.6 billion people to call Earth home by 2050. 7 billion now, 9.6 by 2050. All of these people need to be fed. Farming is an input-output problem. If we can reduce the inputs, water and pesticides, and maintain the same output, we'll be overcoming a central challenge. Agricultural drones, that is, self-flying planes, helicopters, etc., that are small, are becoming a tool like any other consumer device. And we're starting to talk about what we can do with them. Ryan Cundey wants to irrigate less, use less pesticide, and ultimately produce better wine. More and more data can reduce water use and lower the chemical load in our environment and our food. Seen this way, what started as a military technology ended up better known as a green tech tool. And our kids will grow up used to flying robots buzzing over farms like tiny crop dusters. So this is technology review. It makes it all sound wonderful. Data will save the world. So let's go now to some of the less immediately wonderful implications of all this data that's being collected. Morgan, you want to ask?
Part two, survey human populations the same way you do the agriculture.
We're getting there. We're getting there. Okay. Okay, so it's called social engineering. We're probably not going to get to the punchline. We'll start. Okay. The next subtopic underneath big data is the quantified person. The quantified person. All right, this is Technology Review, July, August of this year. A woman named Rachel Metz wrote this. I always knew I was short, but it wasn't until recently that I realized exactly how short. That's because I've been trying on a couple of life-logging devices. Life-logging. That's because I've been trying on a couple of life-logging devices. Gadgets that fit to my shirt or hang around my neck, automatically taking photos of the world around me. The results? Some neat shots of family, friends, and Silicon Valley life, tucked in amongst countless photos of torsos, legs, sidewalks, and bicycle handlebars. So that's what the things that are hanging around her neck or clipped on her shirt are taking pictures of. Life logging has long been an activity for a few diehard data fanatics and academics. Early adherents included University of Toronto professor Stephen Mann, who was a graduate student at MIT in 1994, began wearing a wireless camera that could record images from his point of view and display them online. In 1998, Microsoft researcher Gordon Bell started collecting as much data information about his life as he could in an effort to create a searchable archive of his memories. He even wrote a book, Total Recall, arguing that cataloging everything was a better way to live and would eventually become pervasive. We're not there yet, but we're certainly moving in that direction. Smartphones are widespread, with cameras and apps affording plenty of opportunities to log in and share the minutiae of life. Smartphones are widespread, with cameras and apps affording plenty of opportunities to log in and share the minutiae of life, and the cost of bandwidth and storage have dropped precipitously. Now we have access to life-logging gadgets like the audiographer and the narrative clip. Small clip-on cameras that continuously take pictures on their own. Their makers believe that you want to wear a gadget will document your life for you with no effort required on your part.
Wait, I want to have a guess.
I've seen it done with dogs.
And the dogs, so they always
see what they're doing.
Yeah. Okay, I was open to the possibility. She says, after all, I often whip out my smartphone and capture snippets of life as it happens. Firemen washing their trucks down the street from my office, flowers artfully arranged in my living room, a raccoon hanging out next to my apartment building. My aim is to share them and occasionally take a stroll down digital memory lane. Down the digital memory lanes that are Instagram and Facebook. So she says she needs a smartphone every once in a while to take a picture, and then she posts them. Perhaps a device that captures my life as it unfolds, without my having to take time to compose the images, might yield enough benefit to outweigh the annoyance of having to wear another device. I wonder, would it make my family time and my bike rides more enjoyable? Would it help me remember people and events? Would I even be able to sort through the resulting deluge of photographs? I hated wearing a camera at first. I felt extremely self-conscious, especially with a bulky audiographer around my neck. Autographer around my neck. It packs a wide-angle lens and sensors, including an accelerometer, magnetometer, and thermometer, into a package about the size and heft of an anchovy can. I found myself apologizing to friends and store clerks, blaming my unusual tech gear on a professional assignment, but that just called more attention to it. Still, it's good that the devices attach themselves. They look geeky but not sneaky. People can and will ask why you have a weird square or a shiny black bar on your shirt collar. And especially in the case of the autographer and its wide-angle lens, they'll be able to identify it as a camera. The narrative clip's lens is less obvious, so it gleams when hit by light to at least hint at what it is. If somebody has a problem with it, you can simply take it off. Good one. So what she said, she wore, I'm going to just abbreviate the rest of the article. What she said, she wore it around, and it was kind of awkward to wear around, but ultimately, she had all this information, and she had it was mostly garbage, and she had kind of no idea what to do with it. So for her, it was an experiment that didn't work. Len, and then I want to take you one more place, because I want to take one more place. Len.
Spencer, it almost seems to me like with human beings losing their individual selves, as they become more interactive with their personal devices. And as the Internet of Things expands, it almost seems as though we and those machines are becoming the neurons of the grand brain of the universe.
Whether we're becoming the neurons of some larger intelligence, or whether it's simply that there's going to be a loss of the distinction between you and your devices. We'll see. Okay, so that brings me to the last thing that I want to do today.
Self-involved?
What?
Self-involved?
This is unbelievably self-involved. I'm going to take pictures of every aspect of my life. I'm going to record every aspect of my life. I'm going to put it on the internet so you guys can see every aspect of my life. There's kind of a little paradox here, which is if everybody records everything about their lives and put it on the internet, who's going to have time to see anybody else's? Because all your time is going to be required to sort through your own data. Okay. Anyway, let's do the last thing. This is from
Time Magazine, September 22nd. So it's last two Time Magazines ago, okay? And you may have seen this. This is the front cover. It's an Apple Watch, and it says, never offline. I want to read just a little bit of this article. Okay. So you know that when the Apple Watch comes out, it's going to be very attractive because it has all sorts of things that you can do with it. So this is what the author of this article said. It's intoxicating and also a bit disconcerting to have this much functionality perching on your wrist, like one of Cinderella's helpful birds. Wearables get inside your personal... This is the Apple Watch is an example of a wearable. That's what's coming. Devices that we wear, which monitor various aspects of our functioning and feed that information back to us in various ways. Wearables get inside your personal bubble. We're used to technology being safely other, capital O, other. We're used to technology being safely other, like on your computer, on your phone. But the Apple Watch wants to snuggle up and become part of yourself. This is technology, after being repeatedly repulsed, finally establishing a new beachhead. To wear a device as powerful as the Apple Watch makes you ever so slightly post-human. This is new and slightly unnerving. When technologies get adopted as fast as we tend to adopt Apple's products, there are always unintended consequences. When the iPhone came out, it was praised as a design and engineering marvel, because it is one. But no one understood what it would be like to have it in our lives. Nobody anticipated the way iPhones exert a constant gravitational tug on our attention. Do I have email? What's happening on Twitter? Did they get away with playing tiny rings at this meeting? When you're carrying a smartphone, your attention is never entirely undivided. The reality of living with an iPhone or any smart connected mobile device is that it makes reality feel just a little bit less real. One gets overconnected to the point where one is apt to pay attention to the thoughts and opinions of distant, anonymous strangers over those of loved ones who are in the same room. One forgets how to be alone and undistracted. One forgets how to be alone and undistracted. Ironically enough, experiences don't feel fully real until you've used your phone to make them virtual. Tweeted them, or tumbled them, or Instagrammed them, or YouTubed them, and the world has congratulated you for doing so. The paradox of a wearable device like the Apple Watch is that it both gives you control and takes it away at the same time. Consider the watch's fitness applications. Your body is constantly throwing off data, and now the watch gathers them up and stores and returns them to you in a form you can use. It monitors your body. This gives you control over your body that you never had before. The wristwatch makes the idea of not knowing the time seem bizarre. In 5 years, it might seem bizarre not to know how many calories you eat today or what your resting heart rate is. But wearables also ask you to give up control. Once your device starts telling you what you should do, what you should and shouldn't eat, and how far you should run, it's getting in between you and your body and mediating that relationship. Wearables will make your physical self visible to the virtual world in the form of information, an indelible digital body print. And that information is going to behave in the way any other information behaves these days. It'll be copied and circulated. It'll go places you don't expect. People will use that information to track you and market to you. It will be bought and sold and leaked. Imagine a data spill comparable to the recent iCloud leak, only with Apple Watch data instead of topless selfies. The Apple Watch is more intimate than other devices, but the internet isn't getting any less public. So the data that the watch collects will be able to be potentially broadcast. Other people will know how many calories, what you're eating, and how far you've run, and everything else about your body. The more of our behavior that ends up online, the more the internet affects that behavior, and wearables will reach deep into our lives. That's tremendously empowering, but it also makes us vulnerable to the rampant comparison and gamification that infect any aspect of our lives that becomes public. Just for example, the idea of already body-conscious young women comparing physical data constantly in real time is worrying. Lives lived in public become performances, and even post-humans need to get off stage every once in a while. So what's being said here is, as these wearables collect more and more data on our lives, that data is going to tell us increasingly what to do. So we're going to kind of lose control over our own lives. The data is going to tell us how to live our lives. And furthermore, that data is going to be public. So other people are going to know extremely intimate things about our lives and compare us, and we're going to compare ourselves to other people, to other people's data. For example, if you have a Fitbit, if you're part of one of these Fitbit clubs, your data goes online, and you look and you go, oh my God, they did 20,000 steps today, and I only did 15,000 steps. I'm a bad person. They're going to laugh at me. You know, I got to go through 5,000 more steps. We are right in the middle of the argument that I'm making here. So I have to dismiss class for the day now because we're over time. But next week we'll take the next steps in this contemplation. Okay.
What is the argument that you're making?
That who we are is radically changing. All right. So I'll see you next week.